Well, for a long time now, melting glaciers and ice caps and cataclysmic storms and rising seas and longer, hotter summers have fueled concerns that our planet is warming and that we are the cause of it. And it's I think it's caused pretty much some heated debate among politicians in particular, but also among some scientists, certainly journalists, ordinary citizens, about where our climate is, where our world is headed. And Dennis Nimick is our guest today to talk with us about that. He's the executive editor of National Geographic magazine. He was formerly the magazine's environmental editor, and he continues to lead National Geographic's coverage of environment, energy, and climate issues. And he will be speaking on the University of Wisconsin campus as part of my department's Centennial Speaker Series. It's tomorrow from 11 to noon at the Ebling Symposium Center in the Microbial Sciences Building on campus. So I'm really pleased to have him here to speak then, but I'm doubly happy to have him here to speak with you today as we talk about climate change. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And email us at talk@wpr.org. Dennis, welcome back.
Larry, it's great to be here. It's been over three decades since I've actually sat in this studio talking with you about various things.
Yeah, it's been a long, long time. So Dennis actually hosted this program in a different form 30 years ago, probably.
From 12:30 to 1 right here from WHAN Madison. And I did it during the summer of 1974 when NPR was covering the House Judiciary Committee hearings on the potential impeachment of Richard Nixon.
Oh, man. Long time ago. And since then, he's had a few jobs, but for a long, long time, he's worked at National Geographic magazine. How did you happen to get involved in National Geographic? But really, how did you get this environmental interest that you've had over the years?
Well, Larry, I grew up on a small farm south of Portland, Oregon, where we raised sheep and pigs and hay, and both of my parents were fisheries biologists. And in addition to having the farm to grow up on, and I was involved in 4-H and FFA over all the years, my parents also gave me a strong education in the natural world. We were always out in the Cascade Mountains fishing, hunting. And, you know, I saw changes underway. You could see what was happening with clear-cut logging in the mountains, the Cascades. And when I was about 10 or 11, our farm got cut in half by an interstate highway, so I could see firsthand what the price of progress was, especially on my own life.
Yeah. And that kind of brought you to where you are today. What's your and National Geographic? I think has done a pretty good job of documenting a lot of the change.
Well, we've been trying to do that now. I think we had in recent years. We did a story in 1998 on emergent studies that were coming out of the International Panel on Climate Change, and then in 2004 we actually devoted over 70 pages in the September 2004 issue on climate change, and we took a look at what is it, what are the visible effects, what's driving this, what's happening to the plants and the animals, and that has a big impact on things like growing seasons for food crops. And then we tried to put it into a long-term time frame. There's this fascinating emergent field called paleoclimatology, where scientists are out drilling ice cores, looking at tree rings, river bottom sediments, lake bottoms, and they can paint a pretty good picture of what temperatures were like, precipitation was like in the past. And they use that to help calibrate and understand where we are today in terms of our climate now relative to the past.
Well, what's the crux of climate change as you see it?
Well, if you listen to the scientific community, which these are pros, these are people who they're like the New York Yankees. They do this for their life's work, and the basic deal is that through all of history, for more than 600,000 years, there's only been so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And when you have less of it, the Earth is cooler, and when you have more of it, the Earth is warmer. And that's been documented through the ice cores, and those ice ages came and went because of changes in the behavior of the orbit of the Earth around the sun and how the Earth orbited, how the Earth behaved in its own axis. Well, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution about 200 years ago, we've been burning coal, oil, and gas. Hey, they're wonderful fuels. They allow us, you and me, to sit here in this studio today. And they've allowed modern civilization to be built and provide us all the conveniences. We can flip on a light switch and there's mm-hmm. the light. But as we burn these fuels, these rich fuels that were laid down over millions of years, ancient plants, forests, as part of that combustion, carbon dioxide is put into the atmosphere. You can't see it. You can't smell it. It goes up there and it stays there for a long time, hundreds of years. Well, that's changing it's like adding blankets to your bed. And that's what's happening. And that's what's happening to the atmosphere of the planet. We're changing the chemistry of the atmosphere by adding this carbon dioxide to the planet. It's like adding blankets to your bed. And we're seeing impacts from that. We're seeing the Arctic ice cap disintegrate. It's lost about 40% of its area since 1979. 20% of it was lost just from 2005 to 2007. We're seeing changes in growing season. We're seeing changes. We're seeing droughts in some places that have not occurred before. And that's all because we have a more active atmosphere. The atmosphere has more energy in it because it's warmer. Seas are rising, one, because water on continental ice sheets like Greenland and other places, that water is coming off the land and into the basins. But as we know from chemistry class, warm liquids take up more space than colder liquids. Mm-hmm. So we're beginning to see, slowly but surely, seas are beginning to rise. And then we're just seeing a whole series of changes in weather, and it's really not tied to hurricanes, but it's like, for example, last summer in Iowa, when they had the deluge of rain that just sat there over Iowa City for days and days. It's those kinds of situations that increasingly we're seeing more frequently as we get rising temperatures over large areas of the land of the world.
And you still will find some people, scientists, who will say, you know what, this is a natural phenomenon. And we don't have anything, we may have some small part of it, but we really don't have anything that major to do with it. And it's all
part
of a cycle.
You do have people who say that. And there are some who are funded by fossil fuel interests who will say that too. And so you have to be able to characterize voices, and you have to understand what people's motives are. And if you yourself, as an interested listener, reader, and citizen, you want to find out the information for yourself, it's available. You can go to the website for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC.ch, and you can get those reports yourself. All they are really is a compendium of work that's been done by scientists at, say, like at the University of Wisconsin. They did a lake studies that was published in 2000 that talked about how lakes in the Northern Hemisphere were not frozen for as long now in the winter as they used to be. It's those kinds of studies that got put together into this essentially international climate report that came out last year in its fourth edition that document all these changes. And so we see these changes. Temperatures are rising. And what's the cause? Well, that's where computers can come in, and they do. And it's like if you took away the influence of the warming that comes from the CO2 in the atmosphere, in fact, the scientists say the Earth would be cooling now. Mm. We would be heading back toward another ice age.
Dennis Dimmick, our guest today, executive editor of National Geographic magazine, has been responsible for a lot of its environmental reporting over the last several years, and will be speaking on campus tomorrow. His topic is Changing Climate, Where Energy and Global Warming Meet. I'm really pleased to have him with us, and you can join in. We'll take some calls now, as a matter of fact. If you'd like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Tony in Juneau now. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there, Larry, and hi, Dennis. Say, I want to make a point, and I'll ask a question. It seems to me that because the mass of the ocean is so much greater than the mass of the atmosphere, that the ocean would have a much greater effect. Of course, it's easy to see why meteorologists focus on reporting the atmosphere, because we all live on land, and the ocean isn't washing over us all that often. But my question is, I'd like to know in some detail the percent that the ocean versus the atmosphere and how it affects the world climate. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, so coming from a journalist and a non-scientist, two things. The atmosphere and the ocean are both responsible for soaking up carbon dioxide. The ocean itself is able to soak up about 50 times as much CO2 as the atmosphere does. That's an aside from your question. I think what your question is trying to get at, what role for the ocean in sort of affecting global weather patterns. That's the big concern, because imagine a big cast iron radiator in the side of your living room. It's like an Oldsmobile. It takes a long time to get going, and once it does, it's got all this heat in it. And it holds it, and then it takes a long time for it to cool down. And that's actually what the deal is with the oceans. The oceans are going to lag the atmosphere in terms of warming, but slowly but surely the oceans are warming. But just as it takes a long time for them to warm up, it's going to take a long time for them to cool down once you stop the conditions that are adding heat to the atmosphere, and then it ultimately exchanges with the ocean.
Interesting question. Thank you, Tony, for calling. Appreciate it. Art in Danbury, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Art.
Hello. I am curious as to whether or not there have been any projections as to possible winners in the climate change and global warming. One specific issue I'd like addressed is, it's my understanding that the Great Lakes have decreased in volume significantly over the past few years, and whether the increase in melted water from global ice packs might actually result in an increase in Great Lakes levels.
I think a good place to start is to look at a map of the size of the basin of the Great Lakes, and what you will see is that the watershed that feeds the Great Lakes is not that much bigger than the lakes itself, and there isn't any permanent ice in that basin. So if you lose ice in Greenland, or you lose ice in the Rockies or the Alps, that's not going to have any impact. I think where something like the Great Lakes is going to be affected, and this is one area that is of some concern, the Arctic ice cap is essentially the air conditioner for the Northern Hemisphere. We're losing it. In the summertime, the ice is disintegrating. Scientists who studied the Arctic ice cap 4 years ago figured it would be 2100 before the Arctic Ocean was going to be free of ice in the summer. Now they're saying because of an increase in the disappearance of the ice by the middle of the next decade, that ice could be gone in the summer. Well, that's great for transportation and shipping and commerce and mineral exploration, and maybe there's some oil up there and all that, but you've lost your air conditioner, and all this is a huge unknown. And one of the biggest unknowns is, so you lose that ice cap up there, what does that do to wind patterns in the Northern Hemisphere? What impact is that going to have on the way storms form, where they form, where precipitation falls and when, and to what degree, how severe? And the Great Lakes are very dependent upon a consistent and reliable pattern of storms and rainfall. And if you lose that sort of air conditioner that's at the top of the continent, at the top of the world, what impact does it have on precipitation patterns that are going to recharge the Great Lakes? What kind of impact is it going to have on precipitation patterns that, say, the great grain-growing regions of the center of the United States and Europe have? It's all a huge question.
Yeah, it's a big question. Dennis Dimmick, our guest. Thanks very much for calling, by the way, Art. And we have more callers online, but still a chance for you to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.com. www.greenpeace.org, talking about the challenge of climate change today with Dennis Dimmick, who will be speaking tomorrow here on campus as part of the Life Sciences Communications Centennial Series, and we'll talk a little bit about that, too. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Climate change, the topic with Dennis Dimmick, executive editor of National Geographic magazine. Larry Mueller here. Again, give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Paul in La Crosse is up next, so let's go to Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I just heard about a new book called Red Hot Lies, which is supposed to debunk all the stuff about global warming and climate change and that stuff. I'm wondering, after all the panels that have met and said that we have climate change, and organizations like the National, everybody has said there is climate change, why is it that there are still so many people who can make a living writing books and claiming that all you guys are lying to us? Why is it impossible for your organization, you or your people like you, or the scientists and doctors and so forth, to mount a successful offense against these people who call you liars?
Well, that's an interesting question. Red Hot Lies in itself is a provocative title. Look, we live in a democracy, and everybody has their right to their own opinions. They don't necessarily have the right to their own facts. I guess it would be interesting to find out who that person is, where do they get their money, what are their motives. I mean, remember, the people who have agendas, all they really have to do is to create doubt in the minds of the public. And the other side that's trying to manifest evidence and observation and to show that change is actually occurring and the relationship between the kinds of fuels we use and the effects they're causing. You know, they're the ones who are having to try to push the ball down the field, and then you have others who just sit there and say cry foul, and they say, well, and they often get an equal footing, often in the media, and yeah. And you know, often you get stories that are printed where, you know, a scientific paper will get published, and then a reporter will spin the Rolodex, and they've been asked to, I've got to go find the other side, and so they go find some other person who may well be, you know, who may be in the business of trying to create doubt, and then a news report is put out that reports on the study, and then there's a quote in there from somebody else who may try to debunk it, and it gives equal weight to the argument, and the voices aren't really characterized in the reports, and so no wonder the public reads these things and goes, well, who's right?
Yeah, who's right? Christopher Homer is the author of the Red Hot Lies, and he also has a book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming. So he's making
a business out of it. Well,
yeah. Well, there you have it, Paul. Dennis in Combined Locks. It's your turn now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I was probably, you're talking about 25 years ago, I was sitting in a doctor's office, and I can't even remember what the magazine it was where the scientists did this expedition up by Greenland. And they were in Nova Scotia. And I just remember it, you know, I was just kind of keying in on the conversation. And they had said that years, I mean, you're talking about a long time ago, probably before the Vikings or somewhere around there, that, if I remember correctly, that climate, it was very, very hospitable to growing grapes, everything. I mean, it was really, really different. And I guess I was kind of wondering about that, kind of reflecting back at that, is this a warm-up, and then maybe somewhere down the road it might be an ice age again? I guess just throwing that out there, if you knew anything about that article.
During the medieval period, there was warmer, and in southern Greenland, they were settling and farming, and there have always been changes in climate. That's actually one of the key things you need to keep in mind, that over history, this sort of temperate environment that we have been enjoying the last 10,000 years that's allowed human civilization to develop is actually the exception and not the norm. And where has that come from? Well, it's come through the changes in the orbit of the Earth around the sun. It's come from the changes in the output of the sun. But it's very difficult, you know, when you're trying to figure out what it was like on the planet a long time ago, you can only infer by using what's called proxy records, where nobody was there to record it with thermometers and anemometers. So you're using these they call them proxies, whether it's ice cores and whether or not we would be entering another ice age. Yes, that actually, if you read on the plane yesterday coming out, I actually read that section of last year's report from the climate scientists that said if we did not have the effects in the atmosphere from the burning of the fuels now, we'd probably be entering a cooling period.
Interesting. Thanks, Dennis. David in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, David.
Yes, good morning. My question is that it seemed to me in my earth science classes that I learned that, like heat, that the oceans have an enormous capacity to absorb CO2 and that it's buffered in some way. Has there been any study of that and where we are in that buffer system? Is the oceans reaching a critical point where they can absorb CO2?
The oceans, compared to the atmosphere, absorb about 50 times more CO2 than the atmosphere. About half of that absorption comes from plants in the ocean. Phytoplankton blooms. They're really vital in the ability of the ocean to soak up CO2. Some people who've talked about geoengineering the planet have said, well, give me a tanker of iron and I'll freeze the world, meaning that we'll go out and we'll dump iron in the ocean and it'll cause phytoplankton blooms and it'll finally soak up all the CO2. But that's probably not going to happen. But what's more fascinating recently, in this is a who knew thing about the ocean. As the ocean tries to sink that CO2 and absorb it from the atmosphere, the oceans are becoming slightly ever more acid. And we're already seeing it. We're already seeing it in the beginnings of deterioration of small calcareous organisms like pteropods, some impacts on coral reefs. And the projections to 2100 at the rate where the ocean is trying to absorb CO2 in some cooler areas like around Antarctica, shelled organisms are just going to dissolve.
Oh, interesting. Thank you, David. Gary in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Gary.
Good afternoon or good morning.
Morning.
Still morning here. I recall reading an article in regards to the in Siberia, the tundra is thawing, and also in Alaska. And when the tundra thaws, you have a decomposing vegetable matter underneath. And they're saying that this alone may put us at the breaking point because of the release of CO2. Have you read anything in regards to that?
Yes, indeed. There have been increasing number of studies on the activation of the permafrost. Imagine you have vast areas of land across Siberia, Russia, northern North America, Europe, frozen ground, rich, as you said yourself, rich in vegetable matter. And slowly but surely, the temperature of this land is increasing. You're seeing effects of it already in places like Alaska, where the ice underneath the ground is melting. One study I read last year that was published in Science from the University of Alaska Fairbanks that was studying the impacts of a thawing permafrost in Siberia. Essentially what's happening, imagine if you had a piece of meat that you took out of your refrigerator and you left it on the counter for a couple of weeks, it starts decomposing. And that's exactly what the permafrost, which has been frozen for 100 centuries, is starting to do. It's starting to produce CO2 and methane. And that one study from University of Alaska Fairbanks said that the Siberian permafrost had the potential of producing CO2 and methane to the effect that by 2100, it could double the effect of CO2 in the atmosphere by 2100, just from the melting permafrost.
And there's always a lot of talk about a tipping point. I want to get back to our callers here, but a point where we're not going to be able to reverse things.
Tipping point. Thank you, Malcolm Gladwell. It's an overused term, but I think it's a useful way to help people understand. I think all I can say is imagine the Arctic Ocean, and in the summertime and in the winter you have white heat reflecting ice. They call it albedo. So you have sun coming in to the planet. You have white white ice that reflects heat back off. Well, then you start losing ice. It's like asking the Arctic Ocean to wear a black T-shirt on a hot summer day. And so what you're getting is that you get dark water around that white ice. And as you get the dark water, it soaks up energy. About 90% of the incoming solar radiation is soaked up by the dark water. And as the dark water soaks it up, what it does, it is in effect like a tipping, that it's the dark water absorbs heat. It causes what ice to remain to disappear even faster. And the more dark water you get, the less ice you get. It's almost like they call it a feedback. Yeah. And that's where if it's a tipping point, that's where it becomes intriguing, because these actions manifest upon themselves. They feed upon themselves. That's where the huge unknown in this is. Once it starts moving, does it move faster?
Dave in Park Falls, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You can put me down as a skeptic. You know, I've done quite a bit of reading on this, and near as I can figure out, all human activity only accounts for about 5% of all the CO2 released in the air. The IPCC came out a year or two ago and said the cows in the world put out more CO2 than all the planes, trains, cars, and forms of transportation do. You know, if you look back right now, since 1998 or 2001, something like that, in those, depending upon the data you look at, the Earth stopped warming. Alaska, which you just talked about, the glaciers are now growing again in Glacier Bay. I was there last September. And the head of, the founder of UW's meteorological department, Professor Bryson, I believe he's deceased, said you could spit in the air and cause as much effect on global warming as CO2 does. So, and then finally, I would say that I think that, you know, you talk about the energy industry, that's this evil force behind talking about that global warming isn't happening. I suspect it has an awful lot to do with grant money. If I was to put out a grant and say, I want to study the mating habits of squirrels, that probably wouldn't be nearly as accepted as if I said I wanted to study the effect of global warming on such subject. And so that's where I come down. I'm curious in your response.
Wow. Thanks for calling, Dave. Appreciate it. Well, Dennis?
Point one, the amount of CO2 that we put out. The key point in that is not the amount of CO2 that we put out. The key point is whether or not the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is going up or down. And the amount of carbon dioxide that circulates in the global ecosystem annually between plants, between the land, vastly is much greater than the amount of CO2 that people are putting out. You're absolutely right. But as the scientists will say, it's the flux. It's not the total amount. It's the difference at the end of the day. And if you look, for example, at what Charles Keeling started doing in 1958 at Mauna Loa, he was trying to figure out, is CO2 going up in the atmosphere? And it's got physical properties that it's radiate. It traps heat. It's got the property of lasting for a very long time in the atmosphere. And as you add more of it, you trap more heat. If, as far as the Glacier Bay ice, the biggest thing that people have to keep in mind is if you look in one place, you may not see the changes. But once you start looking globally and you start looking at things like the aggregation, if it's not just one glacier, then it may be that one glacier out of all glaciers is growing. But you have to look at the preponderance of the average. You have to look at all of them before you can say yes or no. Because it may be what you see often, and it's like some will say, you know, Drudge will say, well, gee, it's freezing in Boston this year, so where's the global warming? But in fact, that's one of the most intriguing things. You have a more active atmosphere that gives you more intense activity. And then you have to look overall and you have to go, oh, well, yes, it got really cold in this one place, but look over here, it got warmer in 10 other places to a much greater degree. And so you have to look overall at the larger situation. And, you know, I don't know what to say about the grant money thing.
I don't either. So as you look at overall, you look at the glaciers overall in the world, they're melting.
if you look at continental glaciers, if you look at Greenland, if you look at the Arctic ice cap, if you look at those, what you're seeing is you're seeing a disintegration of ice. And so the question is, okay, so if you don't want to accept that we have an impact on it, then you still have to accept the idea that change is afoot, weather patterns are changing. And then if, for example, if you are a water manager in the state of California and you're losing your snowpack and you're responsible for making sure that water supplies are going to be available to L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco, you could still be a climate skeptic, but you better have an adaptation plan in place for mid-century when you're going to have half your snowpack. So it's not a question of belief or not. It's a question of like, well, gee, these changes are unfolding. And if you're in a position of trying to make sure that you're going to be able to do things like continue to grow food, that you have to, if you're an agricultural scientist, you know, it takes a long time to do the work necessary to produce, say, drought-tolerant crops. And so you have to plan and work long times in advance to be able to prepare for the changes. And it's all being observed. So the question is, if you don't want to accept the evidence, then there's nothing I can do about it.
No. Dave, thanks, Dave, for calling. Dave in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Dave, hello.
Hey, this is a great program, and your guest is very well spoken and hitting right at the right issues. The thing about the grants is it's ridiculous. That's just a talking point. I wonder, you know, when I teach my students in conservation biology or ecology, we talk about how the skeptics manipulate information, and one of the ways they do that is by talking about the average change. Oh, look, it's only a half a degree on average. Well, what I impart to the students, and I wondered if your guest could comment, is that, you know, evolutionarily, it's the extremes that matter. You don't die from the average temperature. You freeze to death or you burn to death. And it's that change, slight changes in extremes that can have huge impacts on species. Here in Wisconsin, you go below 23 degrees on average in some of these groundwater-fed streams, and, boy, there go your brook trout. That's the tipping point for that species. It's not the total even. It's how that extreme plays out. I wonder if your guests could comment.
Yeah, there's two things. I mean, that's what the IPCC scientists have spoken to. It's like you're seeing both your changes in the mean and in the variability. So as the mean, you may well see, I mean, what, during the last ice age, we were only, what, 6 degrees centigrade on average cooler than we are now. It doesn't take a lot to go from one state to the other. But it's the variability that you're seeing in temperature patterns that has, you're seeing greater extremes between cold and warm, and that does have huge impacts on plants and animals and their ability to survive.
Ray in Merrimack, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Ray.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Yes, good afternoon.
Yes. You did set up your program at the beginning to the point where if you were a skeptic, you had ulterior motives, and it wasn't scientific, and your program has run that way. I would like to, you know, at the beginning of the previous ice age, not the Wisconsin stage, but at the beginning of the Illinois stage, or at the end of it, I mean, when we started to warm up, how fast did the Earth warm up at that stage as opposed to what it's doing now? We're only about, 11, 12,000 years out of the Wisconsin ice age, and we're still warming up, and that's just for the last 2 million years, that's about natural. So I believe that putting our CO2 in the air is affecting it, but I don't believe it's the only cause.
Dennis, a comment for that?
Well, I don't really know what to say. At the end of the last ice age, for example, there was a rapid warming, and then there was a rapid cooling. We need to keep in mind that today the difference is that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere right now is about one-third higher than it's been in the last 600,000 years. And the more CO2 you have in the atmosphere, the warmer the planet is. The less you have, the cooler it is. If you don't want to accept that the burning of hydrocarbon fossil fuels is the cause behind that, I'd be very interested in understanding what is driving that. Because physics professors, scientists, know that the presence of CO2 in the atmosphere has a impact on the behavior of the atmosphere. And we're beginning to see those changes on the planet. And if you don't want to accept that and go on living the way you do, fine. I think there are some of us, though, for example, me, I'm concerned about at least trying to help explain and illuminate these issues, especially for my children and their children, so they understand what they're inheriting, because it's essentially to be forewarned is to be forearmed. And you're in a position of trying to help people understand how to live and survive in a changing planet.
And Bruce in Milwaukee will give you a shot. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Well, Dennis, that was the most eloquent defense that you could make to your skeptics. My concern is that the skeptics are entrenched in their beliefs that the facts are not real. And to me, they seem to be angry white men who live in the exurbs or off in some rural county, drive SUVs, and they don't want their lifestyle tampered with. And if you lived in southeastern Wisconsin, as I have for the last 25 years, it's gotten much warmer in the winter. There are different bird species that are here. There are different weed species that have invaded because the climate has changed. And if you went from southeastern Wisconsin to Minneapolis 30 years ago, it was much colder. So it does. You don't have to go check every glacier in the world to realize that things have changed, and the weather is much more volatile. We've had highs and lows in Lake Michigan. We've had very dry summers that we never used to have. We've had very cold winters and then very mild winters.
I'm going to break in there and let Dennis comment. Thanks, Bruce, for calling.
You're exactly right. I mean, you don't need to talk about loss of glaciers to see the changes around you. It's like growing seasons. It's like if you just look at a map of the United States, you will see that the growing zones, if you're a gardener, the growing zones have changed in just the last 15 years. And it's like we're losing winter. If you look in the upper Midwest, if you look here, it's like winter isn't what it used to be. Lake Mendota, good example. In 1860, Lake Mendota was frozen for an average of 121 days a year. It's now frozen for an average of about 88 days a year. You want to believe or not, but something's causing that to change. And that means if you're in the ice fishing business, you've lost about a 30-year business.
Dennis, is a great pleasure to have you with us. Dennis will be speaking and actually giving us a sort of a visual journey, too, won't you, tomorrow?
Yeah. It's a slideshow that's built from articles that we've been publishing on energy and climate for the last 10 years.
So he'll be speaking as part of our Centennial Speakers Series on the UW-Madison campus for the Department of Life Sciences Communication. And if you'd like to see some fantastic photography and hear more of what Dennis has to say, I hope you'll join us. It's a free and open to the public, 11 to noon, tomorrow at the Ebling Symposium Center. That's the first floor of the Microbial Sciences Building, the new building on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Dennis, thanks again. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
Dennis Dimmick, executive editor of National Geographic Magazine. Wonderful to have him here to speak to us today. And we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk with you about American wildlife art. You know, on Wednesdays, we try to deal with the environment and the out-of-doors. And Dave Wagner of Milwaukee is going to be our guest today, coming up along with Ken Ulberg, to talk with us about wildlife art and some really cool things that we can see. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.